I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. For the first time, Christian churches have come under attack in Iraq. 11 people were killed in a series of apparently coordinated bombings aimed at the country's Christian minority. It's just 5 weeks now since the interim government took power in Baghdad, but the violence continues. Bombings, kidnappings, shootings. The insurgents, terrorists, call them what you will, have clearly not yet been beaten. And on the political front, there are problems too. A national conference to include representatives of all Iraq's many different political and tribal groups was meant to have taken place by the end of last week. It never happened. The organisers say they hope now that it will take place later this month. So, what's happening to hopes of democracy in Iraq? If holding a conference is turning out to be so difficult, what will it be like trying to hold elections, which are due in January? Are they just trying to go too fast, or are these the inevitable problems in a still far from stable political environment? After decades of dictatorship, can a country turn to democracy in a matter of a few months? We'd like to hear your thoughts on democracy in Iraq. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this hour on The Connection, Laith Kuba, who has been an anti-Saddam activist for many years and is now at the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C., from where he joins us today. And Noah Feldman of New York University Law School, who is a former constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He joins us by phone from Westport Island in Maine. We'll be talking to them in just a moment, but first, let's get the latest from the BBC's Peter Grester in Baghdad. Peter, thanks for taking the time to be with us today. Yesterday was a bad day in Iraq. What's today been like?
Today has been a little quieter, although we've seen the consistent snipings, mortar attacks and roadside bombs. It is a fairly consistent picture. I think every day, even just around the Baghdad district alone, the intelligence sources say that we're getting about 40 separate incidents. It is very, very high and it is consistently rising. But nothing spectacular, certainly nothing on the scale of yesterday's bombings.
And Peter, what are people saying today about what happened yesterday? Because there was an impressive degree of coordination and planning about these attacks, was there not?
That's right, Robin. It was very impressive indeed, and very concerning as well, I think, for the authorities here. We saw five bombs targeted at churches, four of them around Baghdad and one up in Mosul. They saw, as you mentioned earlier, 11 people killed and more than 50 people injured. We also understand that two more bombs were defused from other churches around Baghdad. Those bombs didn't go off. But clearly, the fact that all of these five devices went off over such a large geographical area and within really about half an hour of one another suggests that it was very well coordinated indeed and there was a fairly sophisticated degree of planning.
And who do the authorities in Baghdad think are most likely to have been responsible?
The Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is the man that most of the authorities here are blaming for this one. But there really isn't any kind of hard evidence. There's no intelligence evidence that links these attacks to him. The government is only really saying that it bears the hallmarks of his attacks. Frankly, I think we've got to be fairly careful about this, though, because it's very, very difficult. No one's really been able to define exactly what the militants are, who they are, how they're organized, whether there is any coordination. And I think there is a tendency to blame any big attack on al-Zarqawi, regardless of what the evidence suggests.
And Peter, just a question, if I may, about this national conference that was due to take place and which has now been postponed. Was the reason for that postponement, as far as you've been able to make out, principally the kind of violence that we're just talking about?
No, on the contrary, I really don't think that violence was the key issue here. I mean, it's always a concern, and security is something that is right at the very top of the agenda for the organisers. But fundamentally, the problems were a lack of preparations on the political sphere. There has been a tremendous amount of disputes over who would participate in this conference. They were supposed to have 1,000 people coming down, but a few days before the conference, it was very clear that they didn't have 1,000 names. large numbers of the population simply don't know that this thing is happening. And this is really the next stage in Iraq's democracy, and it's extremely important. There's been no public debate, and I think the organizers recognized that politically they were way behind, too far behind to organize it on the timescale that originally planned.
The aim of a conference of this kind, presumably, was to try to bring people together, to foster some idea that there are common interests that everybody in Iraq shares. What we saw yesterday, the kind of targeted attacks on the Christian minority, presumably are designed to do precisely the opposite, to tear people apart.
That's the way it looks. It's obviously impossible to know what was going on in the minds of the bombers when they planned this, but all of the speculation now seems to be that the bombers were trying to drive a wedge between various sectors of the community. Now, the Christians don't represent a huge minority here. They make up about 3% of the population, and they've deliberately kept a low profile for literally thousands of years. So it's hard to know what they hope to get out of this, except to foster a general sense of insecurity and to really pit the various groupings in Iraq against one another.
Peter, okay, well, thank you very much indeed for that. The BBC's Peter Grester in Baghdad. Let's go now to our guests, Laith Kuba, who joins us from Washington, D.C., where he is a senior program officer at the National Endowment for Democracy, and Noah Feldman of the New York University Law School. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us on The Connection. Laith Kuba, first of all, the attacks on the Christian minority, what do you make of them?
There is no question this is going to push the country towards more polarization. I think the Christians in Iraq for a long time have been the backbone of Iraqi nationalism. They've participated in all of Iraq national parties from right to left. And as a community, they are very much part and fabric of the middle class in Iraq. The majority of them are professional people. They are critical to the functioning of the country at the national level.
But in numbers, they are very small, aren't they? Can they really play a significant part in the life of the country when there are, what, something like 700,000 of them?
Well, I mean, 700,000 of them, but most of them are highly educated. And as I said, symbolically, they are part of Iraq national politics. I did learn, however, that their outlook now, because everybody is talking in terms of Shia Sunni Kurds, that they are being pushed to identify themselves very much as Christians, a bit distinct from their Iraqi identity. And with these attacks, this polarization is going to intensify. And as I said, unfortunately, this is going to push the country towards more polarization. In the long term, it's going to undermine Iraq's national unity in a big way.
So if and when this national conference takes place, will there be delegates at that conference who identify themselves and who are regarded as representatives of Iraq's Christian community?
Very much so. I think now their communities, by and large, are going to support Christian political parties, so to speak, not broad Iraqi national parties. And they're going to argue, we are threatened, we are a minority, nobody is looking after us. And certainly when elections come next year, they're going to form a slate mainly with Christians, and they're going to ask all the Christians basically to vote for that slate.
Let me just turn to Noah Feldman then. Professor Feldman, do you regard what you have just been hearing discussed as in any way compatible with a movement towards democracy in Iraq?
Certainly the case that attacks like the ones yesterday are a terrible setback. And I think that that's also one of the strategies of those who are doing these attacks. You know, the addressee, as it were, of the attacks is not only Iraqis, it's also the rest of the world. And I think one of the reasons for the attack on Christians is that there's one strand of jihadi thought, which is clearly at work in Iraq right now, whether it's coming from outside the country or from inside, that would like to make Iraq the focal point for a global war between Christians and Muslims. And so one reason to target Christians in Iraq is to send a message to the mostly Christian countries of the West that that is what is going on here, and as well to send a message to people who are watching this throughout the Middle East that the people who are blowing things up are actually fighting for the cause of Islam against the cause of Christianity.
So you see this very distinctly then and overtly, do you, as an attempt to turn the difficulties of Iraq, the conflict in Iraq, into a religious conflict?
I do, and indeed to turn it into a globalized religious conflict. There are many attacks that take place in Iraq that are, I would describe, as primarily locally motivated. focused on making it difficult for one group or another to gain power or to play the political situation. And then there are others that are designed to stop Iraq from emerging as a relatively stable and pluralist state and to make Iraq the battleground, for the next major battleground for a global jihad.
Laith Kuba, we have seen elsewhere in the Arab world, in Lebanon, what a religious conflict can do to a country. Could Iraq go that way?
Although Iraq has no history of communal violence and it has all the problems Iraq had were between communities and the government, but they've never been between communities themselves. Maybe we're witnessing for the first time in Iraq's history some blood being shed. Although all leaders of communities, Shias and Sunnis and Arabs and Kurds, have strongly condemned the bombings, but still the facts on the ground are that there are bombs and there are people being killed and holy places have been targeted for the Christians. So as I said, it's too early to say, but certainly Iraq is being pushed in that direction.
Do you see a paradox in the fact that we see this kind of conflict now in the post-Saddam era, whereas during the days of Saddam's regime, there was Tariq Aziz, one of the most visible and best-known faces of that regime, himself a Christian?
Without doubt, this is going to cross the minds of many, many Iraqis. It is very unfortunate that a lot of Iraqis are going to make these comparisons, and certainly for the Christian communities who felt more or less protected before, despite all Saddam's faults, and he's been extremely aggressive in keeping at check all Iraq's communities. But I think he made a point of showing that Christians are protected in Iraq in a way to appease the West and to show them that he's been a buffer zone against the revolution in Iran, so on and so forth. So I think, yes, a lot of the Christians in Iraq are going to make that comparison.
Noah Feldman, is part of the problem, perhaps, do you think, that the move towards elections, towards genuine participatory democracy in Iraq, is simply too quick?
The problem is that there's not enough security to move in that direction. If there were security achieved on the ground, then we could have had elections already some time ago.
That's a big if.
Well, it's an enormous if, and it's precisely the failure to create security on the ground, I think largely driven by an insufficient number of troops after the initial invasion of the country, that is responsible for a lot of the violence that's emerging. You know, when people feel unsafe, when they feel as though the government is not doing its primary job of protecting them, they will look to any association that offers some kind of protection, and that's one way that denominational or sectarian identities can become important in an environment like the one we've got in Iraq.
So do you think perhaps that the time is coming when people are going to have to say, unless the security situation does improve dramatically quite quickly, then we're going to have to start talking about postponing those elections?
I don't think that the government, the transitional government, will start speaking about that right now, because they have nothing to gain with elections still in January ahead by speaking in those terms. But I think quietly people are already beginning to ask that question. And as we come closer to January, unless there's a plan for putting the elections on in such a way as to minimize violence, doing it over the space of weeks or even months, I think it will be very, very threatening to the possibility of postponement.
We're talking this hour about violence and democracy in Iraq. Do the recent attacks on Christians mean that there's even less national unity as the run-up to elections begins? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Robin Lustig. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. We're talking this hour about what increased violence and the postponement of a national conference in Iraq will mean for the prospect of elections in that country. Our guests are Laith Kuba, Senior Programme Officer for the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C., and Noah Feldman, Law Professor at New York University. Noah Feldman, just on the question of timings for these elections, what's the rush?
The rush is that the present government, the transitional government in Iraq, was not chosen by the Iraqi people. It was chosen by a combination of the outside forces, the coalition, like the United States primarily, and the United Nations, and Iraqi politicians, most of whom were exiles. And so more or less, the people who are running Iraq today are the people who are handpicked by the West. Elections are necessary to legitimize that government. and to produce an opportunity for ordinary Iraqis to participate in politics. And that's the reason to press forward.
But when you were involved in drawing up the sorts of arrangements which are now in place, did you ask yourselves the question, how quickly can we do this, or what are the best circumstances in which this should be done?
More or less, the approach was to get a constitutional document as quickly as possible so that the rule of law would be in place, while moving for elections at a time when the public was ready for them, which means a time when there's security on the ground and a time when ordinary politicians have had an opportunity to get their views out there and get themselves known to the populace. And that can be delayed up to a point, but when the government starts to lose the confidence of the people by failing to deliver security, the time begins to close. You know, the window for legitimating the government begins to become smaller.
But you really did believe, did you, that it was conceivable that security would have been restored to Iraq to a sufficient degree to allow elections to be held in a peaceful environment within a matter of months?
Well, it seemed as though that were a possibility, but by no means a certainty. And that has been true since the very beginning. You know, a year ago, the thought that the violence would become this extreme was not particularly anticipated by almost anybody in the scenarios that were being painted.
Leif Kuba, what's your take on the timing of all this?
Well, timing is important. I think I share the view that Iraq needs a legitimate government as soon as possible because Iraq needs a strong government. Any strong government that takes harsh measures has to be legitimate so that it has the mandate from the people. But I must say that the major fault is at the moment is not timing. The major fault is that up until now, we do not have a political buy-in from one of Iraq's main communities, and that is the Sunnis. Up until now, they are staying outside the political process. They are not participating in this interim assembly, and that is not a good sign.
Why aren't they participating?
Well, maybe this is the failure of the politicians. Maybe different community leaders and political leaders have pushed them out. I don't know. But what I do know that in order to address violence in Iraq, this political dimension must be addressed. There are extreme and criminal elements in any community. But when one community does not have a buy-in and is not really behind the process, then obviously those criminal and extreme elements start organizing and being harbored within those cities, and it's extremely difficult to pin them down. So I see the main threat, the main fault at the moment, is the weakness in the political process rather than simply the strength of the government.
We'd like to hear your thoughts on how best to move towards democratic elections in Iraq. The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jerry is on the line from Arlington in Massachusetts. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for taking my call. Well, you're welcome. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thought is democracy is a grassroots process. Myself being French, and in my national anthem, having words that talk about the revolution of our people against our dictatorship of the time, if you want to say it, gives us ownership of the whole process of democracy. Nobody came and decided to violate the rules of sovereignty of our country and told us how we should conduct and how we should build our government. As a matter of fact, I was listening on the French news, Iraqi people who were complaining that they don't feel that they've truly owned the democracy or the democracy to come for their country because they were not the one who actually took Saddam Hussein down, and they are not the one who actually built their new charter.
Okay, but we are where we are. What happened, happened. What does that mean, do you think, for the current circumstances?
No, I think it's going to fail. I think right now you have theocracies who are playing on the battlefield for control of government. We're dealing not with religious movement. We're dealing with theocracy, people who actually mix religion and government really deep. And I think this is what's going on, is that they're just playing in that field for government to grab the control of the area. And these are the players. And I think we are making a anachronistic, I guess is the word in English, mistake by thinking that we can go there and help them build a democracy when, in fact, there is more than just a democracy as an offered or a proposal to these people and that they can relate to.
Okay, Jerry, thanks for that. Noah Feldman, if Jerry is right, then this entire project was doomed to fail from the outset, because the theory is that democracy has to be owned by the people themselves. It cannot be handed to them from outside.
The point on which I agree with Jerry is that no one can cause another people to become democratic. You have to have elections and people have to choose for themselves. But I'm afraid that's where our agreement ends, because I don't think that the overwhelming majority of Iraqis reject the idea of democratic self-government. I think, to the contrary, even the Islamist parties that seem to be doing the best in the polls that are available are saying that they want Islam and democracy simultaneously. They don't think that separation of religion and the state is necessary to achieve democracy, but they care very much about self-determination. So I think in the end, it will be up to the Iraqis, but I think many Iraqis want a democratic government.
But you yourself concede that you can't have that kind of democracy without security, and surely it was inevitable that after the kind of military action that we saw, it was going to take a considerable length of time for security to be reestablished.
I think that in the presence of such a small number of troops, which is all that it took to bring down the regime of Saddam, it was basically impossible in retrospect to govern the country. And I think without a much larger number, you're probably right that some degree of violence locally was very, very likely to occur, especially because borders were open and many people came in from outside the country.
Leith Kuba, democracy embraces a huge variety of systems. There are many different kinds of democracies, some less perfect than others, none of them completely perfect. Can some kind of democracy be introduced into Iraq, even in the current political environment?
I think there is political will amongst the Iraqis. All opinion polls show that Iraqis want a democratic system. Iraq has a developed middle-class educated people, and I think it can be done. There are many forms and shapes to it. I think the problems we are facing today primarily are coming from the fact that the state of Iraq, all its institutions have been dismantled, whether it's control over borders, whether it's its police, its army, and hence it pushed the country into chaos. But I think in terms of political will, cultural compatibility, the ability to have some form of democracy, I think the country can and will have it ultimately. The real challenge, unlike, I think, France or other countries, Iraq is not homogeneous, so we do have that dimension of polarized communities who are insecure. We do have another challenge, that Iraq neighbors have influence over Iraq's communities. That is just going to complicate the process. But ultimately, I think democracy is the only way to keep Iraq stable and united.
But you see, you talk about polarized communities. Don't elections increase the risk of polarization?
I think in the first phase they will. Because Iraqis, all of them, have been repressed for so long. In the first round of voting, I think everybody would vote for their own ethnic or communal leader, just as an expression of self-identity. But once there is a process and people have more options, I think people are going to look at real issues, real political issues, rather than simply voting for ethnic identities. But in phase one, in the elections that would be next January, I think we are going to see a lot of reinforcement of these communal and ethnic currents.
Jim is on the line from Ogdensburg in New York. Jim, hi.
Hi there. I think the evolution of freedom in Iraq is kind of feeds into what I was thinking, that these attacks are, the very nature of them defines them as being extreme elements, therefore small numbers of Iraqis or external forces inside the country. And I think it's actually a symptom of the freedom, the fact that Saddam's forces aren't holding the people down, that they can actually have these kinds of violent discussion, I guess, if you want to put it that way. And that freedom in Iraq is blooming, I think, at a very rapid rate. We haven't even been there 2 years yet. And we've already turned it over back to the Iraqis, and in January they get to pick their own people. I just seems to me that it's going well.
You think it's going well?
Yes, at a very rapid pace.
But do you really think, though, that people can freely choose who they wish to represent them in government if there are among them people who are seeking to force them by bullets and by bombs to choose a particular form of political representation?
I think the Irish have been doing it for years. I think we have parallel situations that have existed in America's past. I think that freedom is the fact that, yes, there may be a force there, but in the end it comes down to what's in your soul, and you have the ability to choose and to stand up for what's right. And the Iraqis get that chance now.
Noah Feldman, if come January the level of violence is pretty much what it is today, would you go ahead with elections?
I probably would, but I would try to structure them in such a way as to make them not vulnerable to direct attacks.
How would you do that?
If you say that elections are just on one morning, then there are guaranteed to be attacks on polling places, and then people will stay home and they won't vote, and then you won't have the expression of popular views. I think what you need to do is hold the elections over a longer period of time, hold them perhaps over the space of weeks, include the possibility for people to mail in their ballots, which is not logistically easy, but will at least enable people to vote without leaving the safety of their homes. And then I would simply acknowledge that the election is likely to be flawed, but that it's probably better than nothing, and that delaying it for too long would probably grant a victory to the people who are trying to make this transition much more difficult.
Leith Kuba, what do you think of that?
Well, I agree. I think better to have imperfect elections than to have no elections. But I must say that the bombs and the violence that we see now is not going to deter people from voting, and it's not going to undermine the process. But my concern is mainly having loose guns, having political parties with militias, having open space for intimidation, for threatening candidates, for asking them to pull out. This is going to be more of a problem. But the actual terrorism itself, I don't think it's going to derail the process.
And is there a link, do you think, between what you were just talking about, the fact that certain groups were not prepared to take part even in that national conference that was due to be held, and the possibility that either those groups or others might not agree to take part in elections if and when they're held?
Yes, that is a problem. And as I said, I just cannot see the country heading towards stability if we do not really get in primarily Sunni leaders and the community at large into the process. They must believe that they have a stake, a share in that process, and they must be part of protecting it, not simply standing on the side watching the terrorists coming from different cities and their neighborhoods and doing nothing about it.
Hugo's on the line from Raleigh in North Virginia. Hugo, hi.
How you doing, Bob?
Okay, fine.
Bob, I just don't think it's going to work. It just will never work. We shouldn't have been there in the first place. And I just think that the neocons they're going to be disappointed. It won't work. You'll never have a stable democracy there.
When you say it won't work, what's the it?
What would you say?
What's the it here? Elections won't work? The whole process?
Nothing will work there because then those people, the majority of the people don't want it. The majority of the people there don't want democracy.
Well, what's your basis for saying that?
They've never lived under democracy. That's my base.
Okay, they've never lived under it.
They're not used to that. We're forcing it down their throats and they're not going to take it. And that's why you're getting these insurgents coming in from various other parts of the world doing what they're doing. I just don't think it'll work.
Okay, Hugo. Leith Kuba, you insist that the people of Iraq do want democracy. What's your basis for saying that?
Well, indeed, as I said, I think all opinion polls in Iraq indicate that. I think, by and large, Iraqis are used to having order, law and order. They did actually have a glimpse of democracy back in the 40s and 50s, although it was a long time ago. But all the problems we face today are primarily coming from the mess we had in post-war, in particular in dismantling the state, leaving borders open, not filling the vacuum fast enough. I think people, by and large, were very patient. They waited and waited and wanted somebody to move in and run the show properly. This hasn't taken place. So now I agree that it is more difficult today, but I still believe that it can be fixed. It's going to take some time.
Noah Feldman, this national conference that was due to take place, it's been postponed. We're told it'll take place within the next 2 weeks or so. How important do you think that is to establishing credibility among the people of Iraq that this process still can move forward, that it can still work?
if the conference had never been announced in the first place, I'm not sure there would have been a big groundswell of public outcry saying, let's have a conference, let's have a conference. In fact, this was really a suggestion from the United Nations, from the special envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, trying to piggyback on something they used in Afghanistan, the idea being, short of full elections, what can we do to get a lot of Iraqis involved in political consultation? But I think most Iraqis are focused right now just on getting the interim government to do the basic job of protecting them. And if it would do that, I think people would be willing to do without such a conference, at least for a very short period, at least up until elections, because after all, the conference is merely a half measure. I think the real worry is that, exactly as Leif Kuba is saying, the fact that the delay has occurred signals that many, many people in the country, especially Sunni political leaders, don't think that right now moving towards democracy is in their immediate interests. And the only way you can have a democracy is if all the major groups in the society agree that it's better to participate in it than to be on the outside.
But Leif Kuba, the point of a conference of this kind, I think, and I was in Afghanistan when they had their conference, their lawyer Jirga, a couple of years back, what seemed to happen then was that it did give people the opportunity to feel that they were part of the process. There were about 1,500 people from all around the country got together, and for a number of days they just talked about what they wanted to talk about, even given the fact that Iraq and Afghanistan are two very different countries, two very different histories. Is there a point, do you think, in somebody like Lakhdar Brahimi, the United Nations envoy, saying it did serve a useful purpose in Afghanistan, it could also serve a useful purpose in Iraq?
I think what happened in Afghanistan, at least, lawyer Jirga led to the birth of an executive body and not the other way around. I think what we are having in Iraq, an executive body with real powers, is already in place. So the role of that assembly is going to be very much a consultative body with very little powers. But the issue of participation here is the most critical one. In Afghanistan, we saw all parties who were exhausted by war ultimately realize there is no other way. They had to join in. In Iraq, we haven't reached that point yet.
Violence or democracy? That's what we're talking about this hour. Is there a future for democracy in Iraq? If there is, how long is it likely to take? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Join us when we return. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. This hour we're talking about how continuing violence could affect prospects for elections in Iraq. My guests are Leif Kuba from the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C., and Noah Feldman, who is a professor at the New York University Law School and a former senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority. Noah Feldman, violence and elections do not mix. Does religious violence have even worse effect on elections than other kinds?
Religious violence would, of course, be very, very disastrous in Iraq, especially if it became intercommunal violence. As Leif Kuba said earlier, Iraq doesn't have a history of Sunnis and Shi'is fighting each other directly. But that is waiting in the wings, and it is potentially the greatest disaster that could occur going forward, because then the country will really be split in a very serious way. That would probably lead the Kurds in the northern part of the country to say that it was a good time for them to secede, which would create yet another set of problems, and that could really stand in the way of a serious democratic progress altogether.
People were talking right after the war about the risk of serious splits between the two branches of Islam, between Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims. There was very little talk about the Christians at that time. Did people simply ignore that they were there?
I think that's basically right. The Christians are a small enough minority, numerically speaking, and have a history of keeping their heads low precisely because they are such a minority. And I think that these attacks are designed probably to put in the minds of Iraqis and as well in the minds of people elsewhere in the world the possibility of greater violence. I should add, by the way, that Sunni-Shia violence, which some anticipated, did not initially occur and has not yet occurred in a serious way. And in fact, there were banners all over Baghdad and shortly after the war saying, not Sunni, not Shi'i, Islamic unity, and calling for communal unity. And so far, with some exceptions, that's more or less held, and one hopes that it will continue to hold.
We'll take another call. Silich is on the line from Great Bridge in Virginia. Silich, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Earlier you were discussing the Arabs turning, the potential of the Arabs turning this into a religious war. I think people seem to forget very quickly that in the early days of stirring this nation to war, it was George Bush himself who characterized the effort as a crusade, which is an unfortunate truth. It's only one of many reasons for attacking Iraq, none of which had anything to do, as far as I can see, with the democracy everything to do with other things such as religion, oil, power, revenging one's daddy and all that sort of thing. Anyway, thank you.
Let's be clear about one thing. I mean, the only people who are talking about turning this now into a religious war are these insurgents, whoever they may be, who yesterday certainly went very deliberately to target particular religious groups, the Christians, in this case. But are you suggesting that the George Bush military activity was also religiously inspired?
Well, he was the one who characterized it as a crusade. He said, this is a crusade. We must win this crusade. Look at the numbers of missionaries who are there. At least two of them have been killed. And when they're killed, somehow we don't really discuss the fact that they're missionaries. I mean, to go in there with our troops and then send missionaries in behind them to convert the heathen to the true religion is really rather shocking.
Okay, Leith Kuba, are there people in Iraq who view things that way, who do think that the U.S.-led military endeavor in Iraq was religiously motivated?
Sure there are, but are they at significant numbers where one can make a general statement that this is what's driving the whole thing? I don't think so. I think we are dealing with a very complex situation in Iraq, and we simplify the description of what's going on. When we're talking about these attacks, we really do not know exactly who and what their motives are and what their agenda might be. But still, by and large, not only the Christians have been targeted, the Shias have been targeted, and in fact, many of the bombings that took place in cities like Baquba, Ramadi, and Mosul are predominantly Sunnis. They were targeted, and there were even some in the Kurdish cities. So I think terrorism is actually hitting everybody, but people have different views. By and large, this is not the overriding view in Iraq.
Noah Feldman, how significant do you believe these religious divisions could be in the current political situation?
Depends if you're talking about religion in the sense of people's deepest faith or religion in the sense of the community that people feel that they belong to. The communal side is actually very important because although there is an Iraqi national identity, the reality of insecurity in Iraq has meant that people have turned back to their communal identities, their denominational identities. When it comes to whether people see this as a kind of grand scheme war, there I would simply say that the majority of Iraqis do not see it that way, but there is a concerted group of people within Iraq, some from inside, some from outside, were setting their minds to making Iraqis and making the rest of the world see it that way. This is a sort of fight for what the meaning of the violence will be and what the meaning of the conflict in Iraq will be. And it's crucially important, if democracy is to succeed, to lower the stakes, to say that this is not a war between Christians and Muslims. This is not a war between the West and the East. This is a war between those people who would like to move in the direction of democratic government in Iraq, which is most Iraqis, and those who are trying to stand in its way. But if that minority does well, manages to cause greater problems, they have the potential to transform this into the kind of religious war that nobody can win.
But when you talk about people's sense of identity and wanting to feel that they have some kind of communal identity, one of the questions that people ask about elections, as we've already mentioned this, but we come back to the question, do elections make that likelihood more real?
Elections are double-edged. They can reveal that there is a large percentage of the population that wants to work together, share power, and move forward in the right direction. But they're also scary because they could reveal that people will simply vote on the basis of their communities, as Leith Kuba said, I think correctly, that there is in fact no nation there to be built, that in fact there's enormous difference and no real will to move together. And I think that the reality is that we won't know this until there are elections. And this is one reason that there's a lot of nervousness about the elections. I think everyone wants them, but everyone's a little bit scared about what they might reveal.
Paul is calling from Fayetteville in North Carolina. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I spent a year in Iraq with the U.S. Army, and I've talk to average Iraqi citizens, and I have to agree, the comment was made that pollsters have said the average Iraqi does want democracy, and that's what I heard the entire time I was there. I also like to make the point that it took our own country here in the United States quite some time before we agreed upon a constitution that everybody was happy with, and we had a civil war since then over disagreements with how this country should be run. So I think the point I'm trying to make is it's going to take some time, but they're right for it, and they want it really bad.
Okay, Paul, thanks. Laith Kuba, it took a long time in the U.S. It took a long time in most countries which have a democratic system now. Are people in too much of a rush in Iraq?
I don't think so. People are under pressure to have democracy in Iraq for a simple reason. In my opinion, that is the only way you can keep the country intact. We have, as Iraqis, tried the previous method, which is a strong man ruling without a mandate from the people, and that failed badly. There is in the horizon the prospect of Iraq falling apart. And I think the only way, in my opinion, is to have a strong government, but it has to be legitimate. And the only way to have legitimacy is through democracy. What should come before that is the constitution. This is a tough one. I hope there is enough preparation put there. It's really testing time for Iraq, its people, and its leaders, whether they can grasp the challenge. There is a possibility Iraq might not make it, but that's a slim chance. I still hope, as an Iraqi, that it will happen.
You would rather take that chance, would you? Have elections as scheduled in January, if at all possible. Run the risk that it makes things worse rather than better. You still think that is better than not having elections for perhaps another 3 to 5 years?
Yes, I believe that it might get a little bit worse before it gets better. But to me, the way I see it, that's the only way Iraq can regain its unity and stability through a democratic system. I just cannot see any other formula that is going to bring back all Iraqis and show them that they have a shared interest in working together.
Noah Feldman, we talk about elections as if they are an end of a process. They're not, of course. One has to look at what might happen after an election. If they are imperfect, if there is violence, if there is intimidation, there are challenges, there are groups who feel that they were robbed, it doesn't necessarily mean less violence, more legitimacy, does it?
Elections are at best the midpoint of a nation-building process, and maybe even a little bit earlier along the continuum than that. There's still going to need to be a force in the country capable of supporting the elected government. And that force, for the moment, is going to be primarily the U.S. military. People like Paul, whom I thank for his service, we're going to continue to serve in Iraq and to try to make sure that this government is not just a government in name only. The other risk is that elections will yield a very weak government, and I think this is very likely, that even if we have some sort of a basically just, basically democratic system in Iraq, it's going to remain pretty unstable with the possibility of political shifts, with the possibility of governments falling. And that means that the moral obligation, as well as the political obligation, that the United States and the coalition took on by invading Iraq is not going to disappear just because there have been elections. So we ought to be very wary about saying, well, look, they've had their elections, they're on their own, and we can pull out now.
We'll take another call. Jay is on the line from Somerville, Massachusetts. Jay, go ahead.
Hello. Hi. I hope you can hear me as I'm driving on the highway with my cell phone.
Be safe.
But you're discussing very important ideas, and I think getting to the heart of it is critical to have any solution. The problem I see is that people use words like democracy and sovereignty with not understanding the underlying foundation for those. Democracy is based on – a healthy democracy is based on respect for individual rights. When you talk about democracy with tribal rights and collective identity, you end up having a distortion that ends up being more harmful than useful.
So you think elections are a bad idea?
I think elections might inform the world about the state of the people there, but if they don't have the concepts, let me just go back and say that democracy is statism at its worst. You know, whether it's a dictator or it's the majority choosing to abrogate the rights of individuals, it doesn't matter a whole lot. Just like the Nazis in Germany, if they vote to kill off all the Jews, that doesn't make it. It can be very democratic and be insane.
Okay, Jay, so thanks.
Democracy is not sufficient.
All right, thanks for that. It was Winston Churchill, I think, wasn't it? He said democracy is a terrible system of government except when compared to all the others. Laith Kuba, what do you make of Jay's point that the traditional makeup of Iraqi society perhaps is not ideally suited to what people in the West think of when they think of democracy?
I mean, I accept the concern that there ought to be respect enshrined in the Constitution for fundamental human rights, without question. But what I argue, due to Iraq's diversity, Iraq has about 10 or 12 historical communities who coexisted and lived together. If those people, the Iraqis, with all their different ethnic and religious and cultural background, want to form a modern system, I just cannot think of any other system that can work and serve their interests, their fulfill their aspirations, other than have a democratic framework. Any other form is not going to work. That is the reason I think Iraqis will realize very soon. I'm sure they love the idea now. Maybe they don't have the same depth in understanding it. But very quickly, once they are in the process, they would realize that this actually works because we are different. We are of different backgrounds, and we ought to respect these fundamental rights. So on that point, I think unlike homogeneous states, there is no fear that there is going to, democracy would lead to statism as at its worst.
Noah Feldman, we talk about democracy and elections as if they are the same thing, but there's much more to democracy than elections, isn't there? The rule of law, for example.
When we say democracy today, we generally mean a democracy that doesn't only have the rule of the majority, but also has strong protection of minority rights through guarantees that are written in the Constitution and that are also embodied in actually existing institutions that protect those minorities. And those range from courts that will stand up and say that the majority can't do this or that, to actually an executive body that listens to the courts and that respects individual rights. So, you know, the world is papered with fantastic democratic constitutions that have no practical application in the real world because nobody listens to them. So you need to develop those sorts of institutions, and you also need non-governmental organizations that will stand up and say, look, the government is doing the wrong thing here, the government is doing the wrong thing there, and it needs to be called to account. Those things are very difficult to achieve. They do take a lot of time, but there is a chance of their emerging in Iraq if they are properly supported from outside, and if Iraqi leaders come to realize that they really have no other option, that they have to share community, share power among their communities.
My thanks to my guests, Noah Feldman, law professor at New York University, and Laith Kuba, senior program officer at the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, D.C. We also spoke to Peter Gressler, the BBC's correspondent in Baghdad. To continue the conversation, visit our forums, www.theconnection.org. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.